Hey Fireflies, Paul here. Welcome back to Outer Brightness from Mormon to Jesus. I'm coming to you this week just by myself. Matthew is taking a break, and I'm going to share with you this week what will be our Christmas episode, recording a couple of episodes that we will post in mid to late December for you so that Matthew and I can take a break at that time. As I'm recording this, it's October 22nd. You can see I'm wearing short sleeves here in Northern Kentucky. It was a little bit warmer today, but by the time you're listening to this, if you live in a climb where there is snow, you'll hopefully have some snow or some cooler weather for Christmas. If you're listening to me from San Diego or somewhere else warm, it'll be just like the weather I had today. So anyway, I'm going to share with you an essay that I wrote as I was kind of towards the end of my time in the LDS church. It's a Christmas essay, and I'm excited to share it with you because it will give you a little bit more insight into my story as I made my way out of the LDS church, as God drew me, and also it's related to Christmas, so that will be kind of fun. I shared this essay with my family and have only really shared it with them and a few other close friends, but you'll see in the essay that I was at the time kind of struggling through some of the questions that ultimately led me out of the LDS church. In particular, I had just learned at that time kind of about the multiple first vision accounts of Joseph Smith and some of the LDS apologetic response to that, in which they were kind of attempting to explain the differences, some of the key differences between, say, the first 1832 account, where it's very different than the published and official 1838 account. So, but the LDS apologists were kind of trying to explain away some of those differences by appealing to the fogginess of memory, and that, you know, all of us have challenges with our memory. And so you see me kind of wrestling with the idea of memory in this essay as I kind of look back on my childhood memories of Christmas. So without further introduction, we'll get into it. But I will say this, each kind of section of the essay looks at one of my favorite Christmas songs and relates and interacts with the lyrics and the artists who sang those versions of my favorite songs. So you'll just have to bear with me hearing me read the lyrics that I share in the essay. Because I'm not going to sing them, because that would be really bad if I did that. So here we go. Hope, a pilgrimage of memory. For we are saved by hope, but hope that is seen is not hope. For what a man seeth, why doth he yet hope for? But if we hope for that which we see not, then do we with patience wait for it. Romans 8:24-25. First of all, they miss a white Christmas. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, just like the ones I used to know. Bing speaks the first line as the music flutters in, and then his unmistakable baritone carries me away to my childhood. I write about this song so sentimentally, you'd think I grew up in the 1930s. But alas, and thankfully, since Bing's is likely the most recorded voice in history, many of my holiday memories are tied to this song. During Christmas time, when I worked at Shopko, the Muzak loop would play Bing's White Christmas at least 20 times during a six-hour shift, and growing up in our home at Christmas time, Bing was a mainstay of conversation and a constant on the turntable. As a result, I love Bing, and this is my favorite version of this song. It's a good lead-in to the topic of this essay. Ah, nostalgia. Is there a season that is as intricately tied to childhood memories as Christmas? With just a mention of Christmas, most anyone you talk to will reminisce about family gatherings and cherished traditions. The season inevitably conjures up memories of past seasons past. For me, it begins sometime after Halloween, when the wind turns crisp and the remaining leaves blanket the backyard. My thoughts begin to wander beyond Thanksgiving. It happens every year, some Saturday in the fall, as I'm raking and bagging up nature's colorful litter with a chilled breeze licking at my neck. The librarian of my memory brings out a dusty old book and leaves it lying open on the desk of my mind. As the subdued scents of October give way to the frigid winds of November, I wander past the pages of my memory book again and again. Each successive year, the pages are a little more worn and the images slightly more faded than before. This year, as my thoughts have turned to Christmas and the traditions of my childhood, I've wondered just how much of what I remember actually took place. What of it is real, and what of it is an amalgamation of reality and counterfeit memories that I've created from stories I've been told or told to myself? What can I trust as authentic? Does it even matter? As I often do when faced with a question, I turn to my bookshelf. There I found a collection of essays on memory that I picked up at Half Price Books a few years ago. I'd read a few of the essays and marked and highlighted one in particular. Toni Morrison, an author who has used memory as a very effective and interesting literary device, writes, quote, "Memory is always fresh in spite of the fact that the object being remembered is done and past. Memory, the deliberate act of remembering, is a form of willed creation. It is not an effort to find out the way it really was. That is research. The point is to dwell on the way it appeared and why it appeared that particular way," end quote. Why do we share stories? Really, each time we open our mouths to tell a friend or acquaintance about our weekend or about a particular experience that we had, we're telling a story. Sometimes we attempt to recreate the facts exactly as they were, while at other times we embellish and add details that may or may not have been part of the actual experience. The exact focus or emphasis of our stories might and often does change with our audience. It's interesting to think about this, especially in light of all of the stories that we tell ourselves at this season. American author James P. Carroll wrote that, quote, "The very act of storytelling, of arranging memory and invention according to the structure of narrative is, by definition, holy," end quote. There are, however, many varied kinds of stories that can be told. The question then becomes, what kind of stories do we tell? There are some stories that are sacred. Children's book author Jane Yolen writes that those stories that tell us, quote, "who we are and how we relate to the world and our gods," end quote, are sacred. With these ideas in mind, that bringing something to memory is an act of creation, that is, this act of creation is, in its essence, holy, and that certain stories are sacred, I attempt to recreate some memories of Christmas's past. It is my intention, then, to share a few of these sacred stories with you in the hopes that through this, we can create some shared memories that will become an important part of our shared history. The memories that I do share are the ones that come to me most prominently each season. I'm certain that what I recall is not always exactly how it really was, but it is not my intent to find out the way it really was. Rather, I have chosen certain memories to share in an effort to let you know my heart and to commune with you. I love those J-I-N-G-L-E bells. Well, I said I wasn't going to sing, so I'm not. Oh, those holiday J-I-N-G-L-E bells. Oh, those happy J-I-N-G-L-E B-E-L-L-S. I love those J-I-N-G-L-E bells. Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a one-horse open sleigh. First the sleigh bells jingle, and then the backup singers slide into their lines. Finally, Old Blue Eyes snaps into his swingin' version of this holiday classic. Every year, when we were kids, we made a Christmas trip. Shortly after Thanksgiving, when the holiday lights were lit for the season, we took a trip to Temple Square to see them. That walled city block forms the spiritual heart of my childhood landscape. The granite temple with its multiple spires rising out of lush gardens in the middle of a desert represents something sublime and beautiful to me. Christmas wasn't the only time we visited Temple Square, but the Christmas trip was a pilgrimage of sorts, a trek of religious experience. So it wasn't a one-horse open sleigh, but we'd all pile into the chocolate-brown Ford LTD station wagon or the white Ford Econoline or green Dodge full-size van, depending on the year. If we were in the station wagon, chances are Marta and I were arguing over who would get to sit in the bumper seats, or we were sitting in them together, struggling to establish legroom rights. I can picture the trip vividly, even though it's been a number of years since I made it. Dad backs out of the driveway and we head off down the road. In the east, the sky above the Wasatch is darkening, stretching shadows down the snow-packed jagged crevasses and canyons. In the west, the sun is just dipping below the ochres, the sky above scattered with pink and orange-bellied altostratus clouds and streaks of cold ice blue. It's no over the river and through the woods, but we stop along the way to pick up Grammy. Depending on the year and whether we were still living downtown or in West Jordan, we either pick her up from her apartment on C Street in the historic Avenues District, or from her apartment near 21st South and State Street where she lived later on. No matter how much advance notice we gave her, Grammy was never punctually prepared to go anywhere. She takes her own sweet time just making people wait, Mom would say. Her name was Mary Christina Reinecker Nurnberg. Her friends called her May, and it made her feel old if we called her Grandma. She was short, 4'9" and shrinking, and always quick to remind us that her hair wasn't gray, it was salt and pepper. Her glasses thin and pointed at the edges near her temples. We pull up in front of her apartment. Dad does his best to settle us down, and then he gets out of the car and goes inside. We wait for what seems like hours. The actual elapsed time is probably more like 10 minutes. Finally, Dad emerges from the building and helps Grammy into the car. She smells of a mixture of chantilly, Listerine, and mothballs. She addresses Mom with her ever-present Brooklyn accent. How are you tonight, Carla? While we clamber over and around her until she asks kindly but firmly to be still, once she's in the car, the pilgrimage continues. When we arrive at Temple Square, Dad locates a wheelchair and unloads Grammy, Mom, and us kids to wait in anticipation just inside the gates while he parks the car a block away. Sometimes I'm his little man and I go with him to park the car. Sometimes I wait with the rest of my family. As I rear my children, I wish with all my heart that they could know Grammy. I try hard to remember everything about her. I write it now to save it, to share it. What I recall now, I'm sure, is not fully accurate and not all from my own memory, but I'm attempting to dwell on the way she appeared and why she appeared that particular way. I can see her sitting in her wheelchair at Temple Square, earmuffs perched on her ears and melted snow glistening on the sheer lavender scarf wrapped around her head. Grammy moved to Utah in the summer of 1976, 2 years before I was born. When she did, she brought a piece of New York with her. She loved the city. To her, living in the city was freedom. Even when she lived upstate on the farm with Grandpa and her boys, she longed for the city. She was the only grandparent with whom I ever had a meaningful relationship. Grandpa Nurnberg died a decade before I was born. Grandpa Stegelmeyer died just 6 months before my birth. Grandma Stegelmeyer was deep in the clutches of Alzheimer's by the time I was old enough to put much about her to memory. I don't know who initially found the apartment that Grammy had on C Street, but I like to think that she chose it. As you entered the building, her apartment was one flight down on the left. It was small, big enough in the front room for her piano, two high-back gray upholstered chairs, her small black and white television set, and her knickknacks. She had all kinds of little trinkets, statuettes, and music boxes. Each had a story, and she knew who had given her each one. The bedroom held her treasure, a beautiful antique bedroom set that she had bought with Grandpa. Her eyes glossed over with tears when she talked about the bed set. To this day, I don't know much about Grandpa Nurnberg, but Grammy loved him, and that tells me more than any story. In Utah, she lived just as she had in New York, and as I recall my memories of early visits to her apartment, I imagined that we were in Brooklyn. We sat out back on the bench under an arched trellis of grapevines, and she would greet Bob, Greg, or the other tenants in the building with her heavy Brooklyn accent. How are you today, Bob? The other tenants loved her, and they would stand for longer than they had time talking to this frail old woman from New York. The gossip flowed and talk about what the weather or what happened on General Hospital would fall beautifully from lips curled tightly around her dentures, helping to resonate each hard syllable of her accent. Young bachelors or college students, they all listened intently and spoke with her about the things that were happening in their lives. She would sit austerely and listen to them until they finished. Then she gave them her advice and asked them things that no one else could have pried into. Greg, when are you going to find yourself a wife? We would pick her up and take her for rides in the car because Dad said she needed to get out. Grammy never did learn how to drive, so she sat in the backseat of the station wagon behind Mom and rode as if Dad were her chauffeur. Carla, would you please roll up the window, she would say, quickly pulling her pick from her purse and running it through her short permed hair until it was perfect. When she returned the pick to her purse, she always got out the tiny Bibles. She had two small books, each only about an inch by an inch and a half. One was white, one was red, and each contained a few passages from the Bible. She would read to us, talk about the golden rule, and sing a song to illustrate her point. We'd heard it many times before, but she'd always ask, have you heard the song about the grasshopper? A grasshopper once had a game of tag with some crickets who lived nearby. He stubbed his toe and over he went in the twinkling of an eye. All the crickets lined up against the fence and laughed till their sides were sore. Said the grasshopper, you are laughing at me and I won't play any more. When she sang the grasshopper song, she purposely lost her accent and sang slowly, carefully pronouncing each word as if she wished to pour into it every ounce of effect that she possibly could. I remember her employing that same technique in worship services when singing her favorite hymn, How Great Thou Art. As years went by, she only got shorter. Eventually, she became too weak to get around without the assistance of a walker and could not go up and down stairs every day, so she left her apartment on C Street and moved into a retirement facility. She lived on the sixth floor in an apartment of her own. There, she had the security of staff on hand to help if she could bring herself to ask, but she never did. She especially enjoyed the company of the other elderly people. I would stay the night some weekends. We would play bingo. I always was amazed at her ability to play 10 cards at once. After bingo, she would stay up late watching Baywatch and Magnum PI and eating ice cream and cookies out of Clancy, her cookie jar, that was shaped like a man's head. I slept on the sofa, and she'd get up early and have me run her bath water. Then she'd disappear into the bathroom for hours. I'd lie back down on the sofa and follow her routine. She'd moan as she'd settle down into the warm bath and start the whirlpool. She soaked her bones for an hour every morning. Then she'd loudly gargle Listerine. And after putting on her makeup, she'd emerge from the bathroom beautiful and regal in her pink or lavender flowered muumuu. Once out of the bathroom, she'd make toast with marmalade and boil water for her postum. The pot would howl its whistle and rustle me from the sofa. I'd stand and while stretching, watch her move around the kitchen without her walker, stubbornly supporting herself against the counters. At lunchtime, she would send me to Burger King, where with her coupons and senior citizen discount card, I would pay next to nothing for our lunch. Many times, she sat with me at the end of the hall on the veranda and taught me how to play solitaire. She told me that she loved the game because you could sit and play all by yourself. She said, "It's like life. If you cheat, maybe no one knows but you. But it's no fun if you cheat. You can't cheat yourself." In 1990, she got sick with cancer. The doctors didn't give a bright prognosis. We told her that she'd be fine and that she'd be able to go home to her apartment as soon as she felt better. She'd beaten tuberculosis despite more than 2 years in the hospital and lived the rest of her life with only 1 1/4 lungs, so she would beat this too. She spent months in the hospital, but the cancer spread. They took out her bladder and fitted her with an ostomy bag. Grammy fought to get better, and we had her 80th birthday party at the University of Utah Hospital. When she felt good enough to be released, without consulting Dad, she checked herself into a nursing home, signing over her Social Security checks in the process. Dad had her moved to another facility where they signed everything back over to him, but they didn't treat her well. Finally, Dad told her that he couldn't stand to see her being neglected day after day, and if she would not come to live with us, he was not going to visit her anymore. Reluctantly, she gave in. Grammy loved her independence. She continued to pay rent on her apartment and was determined to go home. She felt like she was imposing, so we did all we could to make her feel independent. We put a microwave and a toaster in her room so she could get her own breakfast. During the months that she stayed with us, I spent a lot of time in her room. We watched Wheel of Fortune, Jeopardy, JFK, and the Winter Olympics together. She loved the figure skating, but tolerated downhill skiing for me. She gave us the silent treatment and the evil eye if we were mean or disobedient. If we disrespected her or our parents, she'd tell us what her mother used to tell her when she misbehaved. Our great-grandmother would tell Grammy that she would let the red-headed stepmama take her away if she didn't behave. When we told her we were sorry, she scolded us verbally but quickly forgave us. Though she meant well, she drove Mom crazy with her advice on parenting and her soap operas. Mom would go nuts during the day and complain to Dad at night. Dad was torn. When it became apparent that she was not going to get well and go home, the retirement community pressured Dad to let them rent her apartment to someone else. It angered her when Dad gave up her apartment. She was bitter. She knew then that she would never go home. She would never again have her independence. The last few months were hard on her. I remember sitting in the hall outside her room as she woke up in the morning. She'd lay in the bed, moaning and rubbing her belly for an hour before she could coax her body into moving to make breakfast and sit up in her wheelchair. Not long after that, she came down with pneumonia and went back into the hospital. She was so weak that they only allowed my parents and one child to visit each evening. Before my turn came up, she went into cardiac arrest on December 2, 1992. When Dad arrived at the hospital, they were still trying to revive her. Per her request, he told them to stop. She had told him that if she was gone, she didn't want to be brought back. They left him alone with her, and he held her hand as she passed. I was in the ninth grade then, and Mom and Dad came in dress clothes, nice clothes, to school, and had me paged to the office just before basketball practice. When Dad told me she was gone, tears welled up in his eyes, and he tried hard to hold back choking sobs. I tried hard not to cry because my friends were watching. He hugged me and I went to practice. As I entered the locker room, my basketball coach noticed something was wrong. I told him my grandma had died. He looked at me for a moment and then said I could go home to be with my family if I wanted. I stayed. I broke down after practice that night. My beautiful Grammy was gone. I was angry with God. He took her from me. This was the first time I dealt with the death of someone who had been so significant in my life. I spent hours that night trying to commit everything about her to memory, grasping desperately into the abyss of death, frantically trying to hold on to every piece of her that I could, while at the same time trying to deal with the cold reality that everything I'd known of her was gone. I wanted to hold on to every special thing about her. I can still feel the exquisite despair of that night. As a Mormon, I'm supposed to believe that families can be together forever, that through sealing ordinances performed in the temple by the priesthood of the Son of God, families can be sealed together and grafted into the family of God, to be forever together in the afterlife. This sealing power given by Jesus to his apostles meant very little to me as a young man who had just lost his Grammy. I still struggle to figure out just what it means to me. What assurance do I have that we'll ever see Grammy again? If I'm honest with myself, all I have is hope. I hope that I'll see her again, that she exists somewhere outside of my current experience, that more of her persists than the words on these pages and the images in my head. Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening. A beautiful sight, we're happy tonight, walking in a winter wonderland. The version of this song, sung by the Cockatoo Twins, is perfect for my memories of the beginning of our Christmas pilgrimage at Temple Square. Standing in the cold near the entrance from South Temple Street, at the southwest corner of the tabernacle, I can hear the bells on the horse-drawn carriages that will take people on nighttime drives through Memory Grove. Marta and I are arguing over who gets to push Grammy in her wheelchair until she again asks us to stop. If we venture near one of the sets of the tabernacle's double doors, we hear the famous choir warming up for the evening's performance of Christmas music. I remember standing in almost the same spot on the day I was baptized in 1986, the cool spring breeze blowing through my damp hair. How accurately do I remember this? It would be nice if I could say that my memories of that experience are all sublimely spiritual. Rather, they go something like this. Discomfort. That's what I remember feeling as I undressed in a locker stall somewhere in the bowels of the large domed tabernacle, knowing that in the next stall was some naked man whom I did not know. I'd felt the same awkwardness undressing in the presence of men when I used to go swimming with Dad at the Northwest Multipurpose Center. As I changed into a white jumpsuit for my baptism, I thought of changing into my swim trunks in the locker room at the pool and how, after swimming, Dad would take me into the sauna. This was always a harrowing experience. The door would shut behind us and we would be in a stall, small hot room with a bunch of old men with nothing but towels on. Dad would dip some more water onto the hot rocks and usher me to a seat among the men on the cedar benches. He would then join into their conversations about politics and whatnot. I always felt uncomfortable sitting there sweating, trying not to look at their hairy bellies, a boy among men. In the tabernacle at my baptism, I looked to Dad to put me at ease. He seemed relaxed and dressed for my baptism in the same way he did when dressing to go swimming. I got comfortable with the idea that we were merely going for a dip. We exited the locker room into a large fan-shaped auditorium. There were many men there to baptize their sons or daughters. There must have been 30 boys and girls to be baptized that day. I met the eyes of one I knew. Zach was in my class at school and was a sometimes friend. Seeing him, I was at ease. Someone that I knew was also going through this strange ritual, this rite of passage. It is the first time I remember truly feeling a part of something outside of myself, something holy. Chestnuts roasting on an open fire, Jack Frost nipping at your nose, Yuletide carols being sung by a choir, and folks dressed up like Eskimos. Everybody knows a turkey and some mistletoe help to make the season bright, tiny tots with their eyes all aglow. My memories of Christmas trips to Temple Square all blend together. For instance, I'm sure that there were years when Lena and Daniel had not been born and were not with us, but I can recall Lena as if she were with us every year, baby-faced in a yellow sleeper, bundled and in a stroller, wispy blonde hair glinting with snow in the lights. When Dad joins us after parking the car, we walk south from the tabernacle toward the assembly hall. Constructed in 1877, it's a beautiful Gothic-style building with stained glass windows. After taking a quick peek inside at the organ and the exquisite woodwork, We turn east and walk the few steps to the base of the Siegel Monument. From this vantage point, we have full view of the temple, resplendent in light and surrounded by trees decked with thousands of white, yellow, pink, red, and green Christmas lights. Maybe a light snow is falling, draping the ground in white beauty. Standing there viewing the temple, I feel as if I'm looking directly into heaven. In a sense, I am. The faith of the people who built that temple is evident in its structure. It took them more than 40 years to complete. Those people faced adversity the likes of which I've never dreamt. Imagine being in a wilderness, fierce and cruel. Each day represented a primal struggle for survival against the brutal elements. The Siegel Monument reminds me of their faith. The story goes that in 1848, the year after the Mormon pioneers entered the Salt Lake Valley, hordes of crickets descended on the crops. The rugged people tried everything they could think of to try to protect their food from the pesky insects. They used brooms, shovels, and gunny sacks to try to drive the crickets away. They tried burning them out. They even tried digging trenches to drown the crickets. Realizing that nothing they did was of any positive effect in ridding themselves of the crickets and facing the possibility of a viciously cold Utah winter without the benefit of a plentiful harvest, they fought on and prayed for relief. Relief came in the form of seagulls, which, according to the story, came in large flocks from the Great Salt Lake to gobble up the crickets. The remaining crops resulted in a bountiful harvest, which the pioneers attributed to a faithful God who heard their prayers. On August 10, 1848, they held a harvest feast, which Parley P. Pratt, an early Mormon apostle, described. He said, quote, "Large sheaves of wheat, rye, barley, oats, and other productions were hoisted on poles for public exhibition, and there was prayer and thanksgiving," end quote. Whether a product of folklore or whether this story represents reality, it is sacred, and it symbolizes the faith of my fathers. They faced impossible odds and the very real threat of death by starvation in an isolated wilderness. They turned to the God who promised that he would hear their cries. They saw the hand of God in what others might see as an ordinary occurrence of nature. Their temerity and faith, which I learned of through hearing the story told and retold in Sunday school, serves as a reminder to me that God is over all. He hears the cries of those who love him and seek him. O come, Emmanuel, and ransom captive Israel, that mourns in lowly exile here until the Son of God appear. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, shall come to thee, O Israel. O come, thou Lord of might, who to thy tribes on Sinai's height in ancient times didst give the law in cloud and majesty and awe. Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel, shall come to thee, O Israel. After standing a few moments taking in the beauty of the lights, we enter the South Visitor's Center. I distinctly remember being moved by two exhibits there. The first was a scale model of Solomon's Temple encased in glass. The detail of the model was incredible, and on placards affixed to the side of the display case, you could read about the materials and workmanship that went into building that structure and the ceremonies and rites that were performed there. Built long after the Exodus and after the trials of the wilderness were passed, it represented ancient Israel's coming of age. The second of the two exhibits was a diorama of the Mormon pioneers' exodus out of Nauvoo, Illinois during the winter of 1846. This was an interactive exhibit. By putting on a pair of headphones and pressing a series of buttons, I make the exhibit come to life. With each press of a button, a different section of the diorama lights up, and a dramatic rendering of the events plays through the headphones. Standing there pushing buttons, 150 years removed from those events, I connect on some level with the grief, frustration, and abandonment that those early Mormons felt at having to leave their homes again. After Joseph Smith was murdered by a mob at Carthage, Illinois, many Mormons hoped that the hostility their neighbors felt towards them would cease. Historically, that did not happen. They tried to remain for nearly 2 years before finally being forced to leave, but not before they completed their temple. 2 years after the Mormons left Nauvoo, the temple's interior was burned by an arsonist, and later in 1850, the temple was almost completely demolished by a tornado. Pushing buttons, a light comes on, and I see a trail of tiny, hand-painted covered wagons stretching out of Nauvoo over the frozen Mississippi. If I close my eyes, I can still hear the sound effects of the burning temple and the tornado. Modern Israel had begun its own exodus. Leaving the South Visitor's Center, we head north down the main walk of the square, past the tabernacle's eastern entrances. Ushers hold the door for those arriving for the choir's performance. I remember one Christmas season when I was in high school watching Marta perform there with her school choir. I can't recall for sure if it was in the tabernacle or the assembly hall, but I remember sitting in the balcony watching her sing. Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright. Round yon virgin, mother and child, holy infant, so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace, sleep in heavenly peace. Between the tabernacle and the North Visitor Center is a large rectangular lawn. It is here that the nativity is erected each year. At the eastern end of the lawn, the wise men traveling by camel to see the babe. Near the center, the shepherds keeping watch over their flocks and marveling over a light in the sky. At the western end of the lawn, the manger, a bright light hanging from a cable directly above, Mary and Joseph inside with the baby Jesus. As we walk the length of the lawn, taking this in, Dowd tells the story of the first Christmas. And it came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be taxed. And this taxing was first made when Cyrenius was governor of Syria. And all went to be taxed, everyone into his own city. And Joseph also went up from Galilee, out of the city of Nazareth, into Judea, unto the city of David, which is called Bethlehem, because he was of the house and lineage of David, to be taxed with Mary, his espoused wife, being great with child. And so it was, that while they were there, the days were accomplished that she should be delivered, and she brought forth her firstborn son, wrapped him in swaddling clothes, and laid him in a manger, because there was no room for them in the inn. And there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them, and the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which shall be to all people. For unto you is born this day in the city of David a Savior, which is Christ the Lord. And this shall be a sign unto you. Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. And suddenly there was with the angel a multitude of the heavenly host praising God and saying, Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men. And it came to pass, as the angels were gone away from them into heaven, the shepherds said one to another, Let us now go even unto Bethlehem and see this thing which has come to pass, which the Lord hath made known unto us. And they came with haste and found Mary and Joseph and the babe lying in a manger. And when they had seen it, they made known abroad the saying which was told them concerning this child. And all they that heard it wondered at those things which were told them by the shepherds. Once within a lowly stable, where the sheep and oxen lay, a loving mother laid her baby in a manger filled with hay. We alternate standing and walking in the cold air. The Christmas lights are few here, giving the illusion that we truly are in the little town of Bethlehem. Spotlights cast a baby blue on the snow in front of the life-sized feet of the wise men's camels, the star leading them to the feet of the babe. Even though I know that this is only a display, I feel that I am standing on holy ground. The story of Christ's birth has been shared millions of times through the centuries, and despite the obvious questions it raises, could a virgin really give birth, and for that matter to the Son of God, it holds great power and warms the hearts of Christians the world over. Why? Ed Kowalczyk, vocalist for the band Live, wrote the following lyrics for their song Operation Spirit, The Tyranny of Tradition. Heard a lot of talk about this Jesus, a man of love, a man of strength. But what a man was 2,000 years ago means nothing at all to me today. He could have been telling me about my higher self, but he only lives inside my prayer. So what he was may have been beautiful, but the pain is right now and right here. There are times when I definitely identify with the sentiment of those lines. There are certain types of pain that you just don't understand until you experience them firsthand, like dealing for the first time with the death of a loved one or facing the dark uncertainty left in the wake of a miscarriage. Things happen in life that make you angry, and you question the things that you were taught as a child, and you wonder if it's all nothing more than stories. As I was driving to work the other morning, I came to a part of the highway that rises up a long incline, probably a 6% grade, for about 3 miles. The highway was blasted through a hill, and on either side, 15-foot cliffs of jagged rock block you in. Looking toward the apex of the hill to the horizon is like looking down those perspective drawings that everyone does in art class, where you learn to draw landscapes with horizons. It was a nasty cold morning. It had snowed overnight, and the wind now carried a cold, dry snow, pushing it diagonally through the air and onto the ground. A dark purple and black stretch of clouds hung ominously low over the hill. The clouds represented for me the weight of the stress that I felt about work, school, and life in general. At the top of the hill, just below the dark clouds, a patch of light blue morning sky looked as if it was about to be engulfed in the massive darkness. As I entered the natural chute formed by the cliffs on either side of me, the road beneath and the darkness above, I thought, I've got to get to that blue sky before it disappears. I felt that if I could just get to the top of the hill before the clear sky was swallowed in darkness, everything on the other side of that hill and in my life would be blue sky. It took a couple of minutes for me to crest the hill. I watched the wet pavement slipping swiftly under the front of my car and kept my eyes fixed on the shrinking section of peaceful sky up ahead. When I reached the top of the hill, I realized to my disappointment that my patch of coveted blue sky had been a mirage of sorts. The blue sky that I'd seen was in actuality much further north than the top of the hill and was quickly being engulfed in the snowstorm moving in from the southwest. Life feels like that sometimes. The pressure seems to be too much to bear, swallowing everything. Then you catch a glimpse of what looks like relief just ahead. You push hard to reach the oasis, only to find that what you had seen was fleeting, and it seems as if you're alone in your suffering because the pain is right now and right here. A few years ago, I was feeling much the same way. Life felt dark, and the loneliness and despair seemed too much to bear. At the time, I was in the young men's presidency in our ward, and a trip to the Louisville Temple had been planned. Even though my faith in the church, in God, and in everything in general was extremely weak at the time, I decided to attend the temple anyway, thinking that if there was any place I would feel something holy, the temple would be it. The temple session, which consisted of performing baptisms vicariously for the dead with the youth of our ward, went off without a hitch, but I felt nothing. When we were finished, I felt quite depressed, so I hurriedly dressed into my street clothes and left the temple to wait outside for the others. I walked around the temple grounds to the back of the building and sat down on a bench. It was mid-November, so the air was quite chilled. In spite of the bright light from the temple, it was a very dark night and the stars were incredibly bright. Looking at the stars that night made me feel so alone, which was a strange experience for a stargazer like me because looking at the constellations had always brought me a feeling of peace and oneness with the world, the universe, and with God. Before I realized it, I found myself talking aloud to God, not praying in a ritualistic way, but actually talking as if he were sitting there next to me on the bench. I said, God, I don't feel you like I used to. It's been a long time. So long that I'm not even sure you're there, and I'm beginning to forget what you felt like, and it's making life hard. I miss you. God, if you're there, please tell me so. I need you. That kind of longing for the divine may be viewed by some as a weakness, but I think it's universal. The response I received that night was incredible. Immediately after the words, I need you, escaped my lips, it was as if the stars began to swirl in the heavens and move towards me. As they did so, I felt as if I was lifted, though not very high, above the bench and enveloped and embraced by the stars. The cold night was gone, and warmth wrapped around and surged through me. Before I knew it, it was over, and I was sitting on a bench looking up at the stars. Sometimes the blue sky comes on the darkest of nights. Still, still, still. 'Tis the eve of our Savior's birth. Still, still, still. 'Tis the eve of our Savior's birth. Mr. Kruger's Christmas was a favorite of Grammy's. Each year we had to see it at the theater in the North Visitors Center. In this movie, an aged Jimmy Stewart masterfully plays an old widower who works as the custodian in an apartment building and lives in the basement. Mr. Kruger's is a meager existence, and through a series of daydreams in which, among other things, he muses about being wealthy and imagines himself the conductor of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, the audience is given a glimpse into the harsh loneliness of the old man's life. The climax of the story comes when Mr. Kruger imagines that he is witness to the Savior's birth. Mr. Kruger finds himself in the manger with the animals and shepherds. Ashamed at first and realizing who the baby is, he speaks to the Christ child. I'm Willie Kruger. I'm custodian over at Beck Apartments. But you know that, don't you? You know that. I guess nobody here can see me or hear me except you. I didn't bring a gift. I guess that's not important. Then stepping a little closer to the baby Jesus, he continues, thank you for everything you've done for me. As long as I can remember, you've been right by my side. I'll never forget when you walked with me, right in those first few hours after I lost Martha. I've always been able to count on you when I felt dark inside And when you were right there, right every time, even when I didn't feel good about myself, I knew that you cared for me enough. And that made me feel better. Like that time I got mad at Mabel Huntington because she broke her pipes on purpose, just so she'd have somebody to see while I came up and fixed them for her. Boy, I hollered at her. Boy, I hollered real loud. But then I got to thinking, you love Mabel just as much as you love me, and I should treat her the way that you'd want me to. I believe I talked to you about that at the time. Well, I started visiting her, and we became friends, and I saw her, almost every day until the day she died. Now moving in to kneel at the baby's feet, Willy Krueger's voice breaks and he begins to cry. I love you. You're my closest, my finest friend. And that means that I can hold my head high wherever I go. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. After Angela and I got engaged, but before we were married, she flew with Kelsey and Holly to Salt Lake to meet our family. She was able to do so because I got flight vouchers on my return trip from Cincinnati by taking a later, more harrowing flight on a small regional carrier instead of taking my assigned seat on America West. There are many memories from this trip that stick out in my mind, such as Holly biting Danny's toe while he was trying to sleep in, and introducing Angela to the divinity that is the Walk King for the first time. But the most vivid memory I have is of taking them to Temple Square to see the lights. Each year now, just as Mom and Dad did when I was a child, I take my children to see a nativity. The one we see is at the Krohn Conservatory here in Cincinnati. The conservatory houses exotic plants from all over the world, a giant greenhouse that provides the surreal and holy experience of stepping out of the bitter cold night into the lush warmth of the desert or rainforest. We spend about an hour walking through the conservatory, taking in the beauty of creation and feeling the peace of Christmas Eve. They always have a beautiful poinsettia display and a Christmas tree made entirely from yellow and red poinsettias, and a real Christmas tree decorated with ornaments made from pine cones and corn husks. Once back outside, we wait in line to file through the manger. In this nativity, Mary, Joseph, and the baby Jesus are life-size wax figurines, but it includes a live donkey and cow within the stable and live sheep without. Each year, the children look in awe upon Jesus, wrapped in swaddling clothes. I'm intrigued by their understanding of the importance of this story. Do they reverence it because I'm teaching them to, or do they feel for themselves, as I did when I was young, that it is sacred? I wonder if Dad wondered the same thing about us as he watched us file past the nativity at Temple Square. 2 years ago, just after Christmas and just before we were to close on our house, Angela's granny passed away after a long bout with cancer. I first met Granny Hope Minton in March of 2000. At the time, her husband Foster, his birth certificate says Foister, but people pronounced his name Forster, who'd had several strokes and for several years had been confined to a nursing home, had taken a turn for the worse and was in the hospital. We were informed that the doctors didn't think he would make it through the night, so I left work early and we made the trip to Middlesboro, Kentucky. It was my first trip to the little town that sits at the foot of the Cumberland Gap. At a time when it looked like she was going to lose her husband, Granny Hope welcomed me, a stranger, into the family and made me feel at ease. Forster didn't die that day. He lived several more years and I had the privilege of getting to know each of them further. Granny Hope is one of the most kind, loving, and amazing women I have ever met. I was bewildered by the way she cared for her husband, spending long hours with him at the nursing home each day. She was there each morning to feed him breakfast and remained with him all day and into each evening to feed him dinner and put him to bed before she would finally return home late, go to bed, and get up the next morning to do it all over again. Her love for him was apparent, and it transcended mere words. His love for her was also evident. He had a hard time speaking as a result of the strokes, but many times they communicated with nothing more than looks and glances. I marveled at this and hoped that my relationship with Angela would develop to such an extent that we could have the sort of all-suffering love that her grandparents had for each other. Granny and Peepaw, as Forster was called, loved me and accepted me as their own grandson. Peepaw showed me pictures of his fishing trips and excitedly explained the fun they had with the squirrels around their campsite. Once I took a ride with Granny Hope up Mingo Holler, and she showed me the road that used to lead to Fork Ridge, where she grew up. It's now impassable due to overgrowth and kudzu making a ghost town of her childhood home. That ride up the holler was like Driving Miss Daisy. Granny had the elegant disposition of a Southern woman. When it comes to Southern cooking, she was the best. Her soup beans and cornbread were to die for, and her fried green tomatoes were nothing short of heavenly. Meeting Granny Hope and watching her care for Forster was an eye-opening experience for me. Maybe I had a feeling that we Mormons had a greater capacity for love than others because we have the priesthood and eternal marriage in the temple. But it doesn't take long after being married to realize that's not true, and all marriages require work and effort to nurture a loving relationship that will last. Okay, sure, we've got the sealing power to bind marriages into eternity, but what good is that if your marriage doesn't outlast the here and now? Seeing Granny Hope's and Forster's relationship helped me to realize just what a blessing marriage is and just what it is that makes it worth holding on to. When Forster died, we made the trip to Middlesboro, and I remember seeing Granny's grief, and I was overcome. During the visitation, I walked outside with Curtis, who was just learning to walk well, so that Angela could visit with her family. I looked to the stars and, holding my young son's hand, wondered if he would remember anything about his peepaw. Granny was lost without Forster. After having spent so many years taking care of him, when he was suddenly gone, it was as if she'd lost her purpose. She tried unsuccessfully to convince her doctor to check her into the nursing home. She kept making appointments with the doctor with complaints that she felt ill. Nothing was found for several months. Then, in a turn of events that shocked all of us, she was admitted to the hospital and diagnosed with cancer. I watched as my father-in-law traveled 6 hours round trip to Middlesboro many times. Eventually, Granny came to Cincinnati to stay with Angela's parents. That was the fall when Dad moved here to look for a job. At Thanksgiving, Granny ate little and sat in a high-backed chair chatting with Dad. Although she never would have let on to her suffering, it was apparent that she was in great pain. By Christmas, she was too weak to get out of bed. In between opening gifts, we paid her visits in the bedroom. That was the last time I saw her alive, and I remember looking at her and the realization hitting me that I loved her. A few days later, a late-night call, and she was gone. We made the trip to Middlesboro for the funeral. I was sick as a dog with the flu. I got a separate hotel room from Angela and the kids, and while they went to the visitation, I shivered so violently in bed that I couldn't sleep. I thought I was going to join Granny in the hereafter. The next day, still shivering, I served as a pallbearer, and she was laid to rest. I couldn't believe that she was gone. In the moments that passed as I carried her casket, I remembered what it felt like to have her hand in the crook of my elbow as I walked her from the nursing home to her car during our visits. Walking with her was incredible. The way she carried herself made you feel as if you were royalty, as if you were with royalty. I remembered walking her down the hill to where her sister was buried and helping her stoop down to pluck a flower to save from the many bouquets. When Granny died, I was lost. I still find it hard to believe that she's gone. In January 2005, after Granny died, Dad and I went with Michael, my father-in-law, to move her belongings out of her house so that it could be made ready to sell. We went down on a Friday night and spent the night in her house. That last night that I spent there, as I lay in bed trying to go to sleep, I was overcome with the feeling that Granny was there. It was so convincing that I was sure that if I opened my eyes, I would see her standing in the doorway to the room I was in. I did open my eyes, but saw nothing. When I closed them again, a wind that was cool and warm at the same time rushed over me. I could feel my hair being blown by it. It circled around me in the bed. It felt good. It felt like an embrace. It felt like Granny. I believe it was. Why do we tell each other stories? Why do we attempt to put into words the feelings that only the heart can comprehend? We share stories to live, to love, and to commune with others. Why do we choose to tell certain stories, and why do certain stories hold such sway for us? Of the stories that we tell, what can be trusted as authentic? I'm a storyteller by nature. I write them and I read them and I get an idea of how to write them better. I'm moved by them and I'm disgusted by them. But I can't stop telling stories. We can't stop telling stories. If you don't believe, and in those moments when I'm not sure that I do, this sentiment sounds absurd. But I'm not advocating believing for belief's sake. Telling stories is a sacred act. We must keep telling our stories and the stories that matter most to us, for it is in the stories that we tell that we find meaning in this dark and dreary wilderness. Stories help us find the faith to persevere in the primal struggle against the brutal elements. Stories help us find light in the darkness. O holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of the dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the Spirit felt its worth. A thrill of hope, the weary world rejoices, for yonder breaks a new and glorious morn. Fall on your knees, oh, hear the angel voices, O night divine, the night when Christ was born. O night, O holy night, O night divine, O night, O holy night, O night divine. I'm climbing the spiral ramp that leads from the main floor of the North Visitor Center to the area above. On the wall is a mural of the universe. Planets, stars, and galaxies swirl round about me in perfect order. As I near the top of the ramp, I can see the opulent whiteness of the Christus statue. This replica of the sculpture by Danish sculptor Bertel Thorvaldsen depicts the resurrected Christ in magnificent glory, arms outstretched, the flesh of his hands and feet still torn by gaping wounds. I'm in awe at the nearly 12-foot statue. Christ looks down on me with mercy. His outstretched arms beckon me to come. I'm 7 and trying to understand what that means, but I'm distracted by the size of the big toe on the statue. Now I'm 19. I've got some experience with sin and repentance and feeling my oats. I'm going out to preach the gospel to the world. I look at that Christus, still overwhelmed by the bigger-than-life size of its big toe. I feel I understand. I think I've felt his love. Now I'm 21. I've waited in line with Angela and the girls to make my way to the upper level to see the Christus. I watch Kelsey as she looks at it. I wonder if she's thinking about the big toe. I wonder if Holly is. Now I'm 28. I've lived some, gained some experience. I've tried to live my life with him. Too often I've tried to live without him. I'm sitting in front of a computer screen, imagining that I'm looking at the Christus. Behind him, planets, stars, clouds, and galaxies whir about in their revolutions. He is waiting. I turn and look out the window. Out on the lawn, a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes is lying in a manger. A bright light hovers above his head. Christ, the Savior, is born. I turn again and look at the Christus. His hands are torn. His feet bear my marks. I want to touch that big toe. I'm sure that if I do, I'll be healed. I love him. I'm Paul Nernberg, but he knows that. I didn't bring a gift. It doesn't matter. He loves me. I know it.